AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It's Brett Johnson on the 4 o'clock show here on your Thursday afternoon. As a heads up, I'm on vacation for the next 3 weekdays, so we have some special programming lined up for you during the 4 p.m. hour today, Friday, and then also on Monday. Today's show is pre-recorded as we have some great interviews lined up as we'll be having some conversations about the 8th U.S. District Court, which encompasses Minnesota, because we actually have some pretty crazy right-wing judges that are actually in our U.S. District Courts here in Minnesota and the Midwest. We'll be speaking with Dan Goldberg of Alliance for Justice in just a few moments about that. Also ahead, we're going to be telling you about a great new gift idea called You Betcha Box, and then we'll also get an update on the impeachment hearings from Sam Berger, who is a former member of the Obama administration who has a little bit of experience in terms of what's actually happening with these impeachment hearings. We'll tell you more about that later on in the show. So happy to be joined by a guest we actually had on our program last week. It's Dan Goldberg with the Alliance for Justice and also Building the Bench. As last week we talked about the effort at building the bench to put more nominees on the courts when hopefully we have a Democratic president. But off air, Dan and I were kind of talking about the craziness that is the 8th District Court of the United States, because that, of course, encompasses Minnesota. And we have some, well, I'll put it this way, interesting judicial people that are serving in the 8th Circuit. So happy to welcome Dan back onto the program. Hi there, Dan.
Honored to join you again.
Absolutely. So, well, let's start off with some basic questions. So district courts are really important because, as we were talking about off air, a lot of times they end up being the actual final ruling, since when you really look at what the Supreme Court actually does, they hear relatively few cases compared to the numbers that actually go through the district courts and the appellate courts, correct?
That's correct. So the Supreme Court hears approximately 80 cases a year. So that means for the vast, vast majority of litigants, the final say is the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals for the people living in Minnesota, South Dakota, North Dakota, Iowa, Missouri, and Arkansas, and Nebraska. The final word on what our rights mean, on what the Constitution says, and whether our critical legal protections are properly enforced. The final word is the judges on the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals.
And taking a look at the Eighth Circuit, which, as you said, encompasses Minnesota and some other states that are located in the Midwest as well, it's a really interesting lineup, because I didn't know this, but there's 11 judges, of course, they're all together, but only one was actually appointed by a Democratic president. 10 of the 11 other justices were appointed by Republicans, including Donald Trump, who was appointed 4. And, well, it's quite an interesting lineup that we have of the justices that currently serve on the Eighth Circuit.
That's correct. And I can't say enough about the Obama appointee from Iowa. Her name is Jane Kelly. She actually used to be a public defender. So a rare professional diversity added to the court, and she has just had some remarkable dissents, unfortunately their dissents, standing up for some of our most important rights and legal protections. But let me just say, you pointed out that the rest of the court are all Republican appointees, and that didn't happen by accident. For example, there was a nominee from North Dakota that President Obama made, a woman by the name of Jennifer Poole. She was an assistant United States attorney in the District of North Dakota. Despite the fact she was supported by both of her home state senators, she was unanimously approved by the Judiciary Committee. Mitch McConnell never gave her a vote. We all remember what Mitch McConnell did to Merrick Garland. He did that as well to lower court nominees. So then what happened is this incredibly accomplished woman was not confirmed to the bench. Donald Trump became president, and instead of Ms. Poole being confirmed, he nominated a white male by the name of Ralph Erickson. And in fact, Donald Trump has appointed 4 judges to the court, all 4 of them white males. So poor Jane Kelly, she's not only the only Democrat on the court, she's also the only woman on an 11-person court.
And as you talked about, Trump has made, of course, four appointments. And as you said, one of them was simply because it happened during that 2015 and 2016 time period when Mitch McConnell was holding up, well, not just, of course, the one nominee you were talking about, but all sorts of other nominations on district courts all around the country. And that's a big reason why Trump has actually been appointing justices at a record pace, is simply because when you look back at 2015 and 16, when Republicans took the majority after the 14 elections, well, they had a lot of judicial seats that remained vacant until, of course, Trump came into office, correct?
That's correct. And then the same thing that happened was Mitch McConnell changed the rules to enable Donald Trump to confirm, in many cases, right-wing ideologues. For example, in Minnesota, David Strauss, who previously sat on the Minnesota Supreme Court, was nominated over the objections of then-Senator Al Franken. Previously, the tradition in the Senate was both home state senators had to approve a judicial nominee from their home state. In fact, that rule was used approximately 20 times by Republicans to block Barack Obama's nominees to lower courts. Yet when Donald Trump came in, as you saw with David Strauss, they moved them over the objection, in this case, over the objection of home state Senator Al Franken.
Let's talk about some of these justices that are actually on the Eighth Circuit that have been appointed by Trump. You referred to David Strauss. Can you tell us a little bit about his background and maybe the other three as well that have gotten appointments to the Eighth?
Well, David Strauss is somebody who he clerked for Justice Clarence Thomas. Minnesota Supreme Court had a incredibly conservative record, including upholding efforts to make it harder for Minnesotans to vote. He upheld a proposed constitutional amendment which would have created a voter ID law in Minnesota. He had rulings which limited the ability of persons with severe disabilities to receive state assistance. He sided with insurance companies over consumers. So even before he was nominated to the federal bench, we knew that he had ultra-conservative leanings. And then what happens is Donald Trump not only nominates him to the Eighth Circuit, but he is on the Federalist Society pre-approved shortlist for the Supreme Court. So the Federalist Society, an ultra-conservative group here in Washington, made clear that he meets their litmus test, and he meets Donald Trump's litmus test of somebody who, in Donald Trump's words, will, quote-unquote, automatically overturn Roe v. Wade, which, in Donald Trump's words, unlike John Roberts, will invalidate the Affordable Care Act. And it's no surprise that when David Strauss gets on the Eighth Circuit, he has incredibly conservative rulings already.
And besides the four appointments that Trump has made, if you look at the other appointments, I still see several that were put on during the George H.W. Bush administration and the Reagan administration, and even going back to the W. administration. So what makes 2020 and beyond, at least in my eyes, really important is that, well, some of these justices on the Eighth are getting older and at some point are probably going to retire, which means, well, we'll have the opportunity to appoint new justices to the Eighth.
I think that's a very good point. I think another point to raise is that many of their decisions already, the Trump judges, you are seeing being even more extreme than Reagan, George H.W. Bush appointees, George W. Bush appointees, that when you're finding George W. Bush appointees saying that Trump judges' decisions are too extreme, it just demonstrates how out of the mainstream and dangerous Trump nominees are. Let me give you one example. David Strauss, who we're talking about from Minnesota, he authored a majority opinion in a case called Telescope Media, where he held that a videography company has a free speech right to turn away same-sex couples seeking wedding videos. he declared that the First Amendment allows for-profit businesses to ignore civil rights laws and refuse to serve customers because of their identity. That case obviously involved Minnesota's anti-discrimination laws when it came to LGBTQ Americans. But the same principle can be extrapolated to really undermine discrimination laws seeking to protect persons of color, women, persons based on national origin. It's really a remarkably sweeping decision that remarkably undermines the ability of state governments, including the state of Minnesota, to protect the civil rights of all persons.
And going back to your earlier point, I never thought we would hear the day where we would hear something like, well, the W appointments are actually not that extreme, relatively speaking. That is crazy to think about, to go back to like 2007, 2008, and think 10 years later, we would essentially be saying, oh yeah, the W nominees, they're not as extreme as the current people who are actually on the court.
It's all relative.
Yeah, exactly. We're speaking with Dan Goldberg. He's with the Alliance for Justice, as we're talking specifically about some of the appointments that have been made to the 8th District U.S. Court, which encompasses Minnesota and some other states in the Midwest. Tell you what, Dan, we need to take a quick break, but coming up in part two of our conversation, I want to talk about some of the cases that are actually coming before the 8th District and some that they've already ruled on. So, Dan, let's hang on 1 second, and we'll get right back to our conversation. Welcome back to AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It's Brett Johnson on the 4 p.m. show, and we're joined now by Dan Goldberg with the Alliance for Justice as we're talking about the U.S. District Court for the 8th District, which represents Minnesota as well as several other Midwestern states. Since, in case you didn't know this, it's made up of 11 justices, and only one was appointed by a Democratic president, which means we certainly can get a lot of right-wing rulings in the 8th District, and simply because the Supreme Court doesn't hear a lot of cases, that usually ends up being the actual final word. So we're going to discuss some of these cases and what we can expect in the future and some other topics. So, Dan, welcome back to the program. Good to have you with us.
Pleasure.
So let's talk about some cases that the 8th has ruled on recently. Can you highlight, well, some of the egregious rulings they've made over the past few months and years?
Well, previously I talked about their effort to, David Strauss's effort to completely gut civil rights laws. Another case that I think your listeners should know about is a case called United States versus Sloot, where David Strauss cast the deciding vote that a woman could be charged with manslaughter for using drugs while she was pregnant, which helped cause the death of her newborn child.
I remember hearing about this in the news. This was actually in the 8th District where this was made? Wow, I actually didn't know that.
Yeah, including David Strauss from Minnesota. And this was the first time in history that this federal law has been used to charge a drug-addicted woman for the death of her newborn. As a lower court judge explained, the ruling could allow the government to prosecute pregnant women for drinking alcohol, for negligently driving a car, for using chemotherapy. This was a 2-1 decision, and the dissent was written by, we were talking about this earlier, by Judge Steve Colleton, who's a George W. Bush appointee, who was also on Trump's shortlist for the Supreme Court. Again, just demonstrating how really extreme some of Donald Trump's appointees are, that they even make George W. Bush's very conservative judges look reasonable. But I think if you look at Donald Trump's appointments, this decision's not a surprise. One of Donald Trump's litmus tests was to appoint judges who will automatically overturn Roe v. Wade. And many of his nominees to the Eighth Circuit have records before they came to the bench of very, very strong advocacy of trying to make it harder for women to exercise their constitutional rights.
Was the process always like this when judges were appointed to the bench? Because as he brought up with Trump, it seems like, yeah, that litmus test is, would you overturn Roe versus Wade? Was that the same even when W was appointed justices, or appointing justices, or HW, or even going back to Reagan? Or was the process a little less partisan back then?
Well, they certainly had litmus tests. I think Ronald Reagan, George H.W. Bush, and George W. Bush certainly sought to put conservatives on the bench. One difference now is because of Mitch McConnell undermining Senate rules and Senate norms. There's less checks. There's less need to obtain bipartisan consensus on nominees. They're able to jam through on straight party line votes in many cases, some incredibly extreme nominees. Second, I do think that the Trump administration has put the desire to nominate ideologues over the desire to appoint people based on their qualifications and their legal experiences. One individual nominated to the Eighth Circuit from South Dakota, currently sitting, he's been confirmed. His major qualification was he was Senator Mike Rounds' counsel. He had never served as a lead counsel, or he had served as a lead counsel in just two trials. He had only one appellate oral argument to his name. He never argued before the Supreme Court. He had no legal scholarship. He never had authored a law review article. It's not surprising that the American Bar Association rated him not qualified. And I'm quoting the American Bar Association here. He had no writings that we received that is reflective of complex legal analysis, knowledge of the law, or ability to write about complex matters in a clear and cogent manner. What he did have was, when he was in private practice, he was an anti-abortion extremist who represented fake women's health centers, trying to make it harder for women to exercise their rights under the Constitution. So I think what is new here is just no concern for even the bare minimum qualifications to be a judge. The foremost concern of the Trump administration is to put reliable ideologues on the bench.
I mean, that seems like a pretty low bar to, well, basically say the American Bar Association says, yes, you're qualified to be a federal judge. And I want to go back to some of the norms we used to have in this country. Was that usually kind of a practice that previous presidents followed? Was that basically, well, at least the American Bar Association said you were qualified to be a federal judge?
President Obama, none of his judges were rated not qualified by the Federal Bar, by the American Bar Association. Let me give you another example. An individual not nominated to the, confirmed to the Eighth Circuit, but an individual nominated to be a trial court judge in Kentucky by the name of Justin Walker. His biggest selling point and qualification for the job was he was a Brett Kavanaugh law clerk who did 119 media appearances on behalf of Brett Kavanaugh when Brett Kavanaugh was up for confirmation. That is 118 more media appearances than depositions that he did. He had no trial experiences. He had minimal experience as actually practicing law. What he did have was being a hyper-partisan who supported Brett Kavanaugh and who, like many of the other nominees, vigorously argued in the public that the Affordable Care Act was unconstitutional. He is being nominated to the bench and was confirmed, not because he's a great legal luminary who will unbiasedly apply facts to law, but because he will be a reliable ideologue to advance partisan interests.
Wow, and to think these are the people that, for the most part, are actually going to have the final say on a lot of the cases that go before the courts, because as you said, several of these, or the majority of them, are not going to make it to the Supreme Court. So these people are actually going to have the final say on a lot of laws that are well enacted and affect people that live in the Midwest and Minnesota and other areas as well, which is really terrifying to think that we're having someone who basically, as you said, their biggest qualification was that, well, he did a bunch of media appearances for Brett Kavanaugh. That is kind of terrifying to think about.
It really is. And just so your listeners are aware, I mentioned Jonathan Coves, who is rated unqualified, who currently sits on the Eighth Circuit. Another one of Donald Trump had four nominees to the Court of Appeals on the Eighth Circuit, and two of them were rated unqualified by the American Bar Association, so 50%. The other one is Leonard Gross from Nebraska. He was rated unqualified by the American Bar Association because, in their words, he lacks open-mindedness and freedom from bias. He's an individual who was the director of the Nebraska Family Alliance. Among other things, he fought to deny Medicaid coverage to a rape victim seeking an abortion, contrary to federal law. He argued that employers should have the right to discriminate against LGBTQ employees. He argued that the Affordable Care Act was one of the worst decisions in Supreme Court history. And he vigorously fought in Nebraska to make it harder for women to exercise their rights to have an abortion. He is an individual who is coming to the court, in the American Bar Association's words, with bias. And the people in the states represented by the Eighth Circuit are going to be caused great harm as he advances his agenda over the next three or four decades on that court.
We're speaking with Dan Goldberg of the Alliance for Justice and also Building the Bench. And by the way, that makes your project, Building the Bench, that much more important. So when we do have a Democratic president, you guys have been kind of going through and looking at some different possible nominees that a Democratic president could make, hopefully when they get elected in 2021 or maybe in 2025, to hopefully reverse some of these trends that we're eventually going to see with some of these Trump appointments. So that certainly makes the Building the Bench initiative that much more important, correct?
I think you're exactly right, and that's precisely why we're undertaking this critical project, which is quite frankly to find more people like Jane Kelly, somebody who had a non-traditional background for federal judges. She had been a public defender, and quite frankly, she brought a different perspective and professional diversity to the court. And I think we have opportunities over the next year and a half to identify throughout the country people who have been fighting for civil rights, for women's rights, for LGBTQ rights, for workers, for clean air and clean water, for consumers, to identify them and advocate to make sure that senators recommend them and the White House nominates and the Senate confirms them.
Absolutely, as we do have to leave it on a note of optimism there, so hopefully we will see some of these justices that you're talking about or people involved in the legal community from your Building the Bench that you guys are going through eventually become federal judges. Hey, Dan, thanks so much for joining us on the program today. Really appreciate it.
Thank you for covering this incredible issue. These judges have such impact on the lives and the rights of your listeners, from people in Minnesota and surrounding states. So thank you so much for highlighting this important issue.
AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. As we approach holiday season, if you're looking for unique gift items, we have a perfect option here at AM 950 from one of our new advertisers. It's called a You Betcha Box, which are curated Minnesota gift boxes, baskets, and bags. And with a name like You Betcha, well, you know everything's got to be local in there. Absolutely love that name. So we're joined right now by Katie Stearns. She is the founder of You Betcha Box, and she joins us now on the program. Hi, Katie. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Hi. Thanks so much for having me.
Absolutely. Well, let's start with a very basic question. What is a You Betcha Box?
Well, I think you summed it up beautifully. But what I've done is made it easy for people to give local. You know, I love to shop local myself. And I thought, you know, this is kind of a lot of work. I think there's a better way. So we've scoured the state looking for the very best award-winning products made by small makers all across the state and put them together into these fun gift boxes that are themed with great Minnesota-centric theme names like the Minnesota Meat Raffle, or Minnesota Hotties, or Land of Lakes Tea Time. So, and they're all wonderful, wonderful award-winning products that we can be very proud to give. Every box includes great Minnesota packaging with our Buffalo Check tissue paper and the Duck Duck Great Icon sticker on there. And then we also include maker stories. So when the person receives this gift, they can actually read about these awesome makers all across the state and their cool backstories and what they're doing and the awards they're winning and things like that.
That's actually got to be kind of half the fun when you receive one of these gift boxes, is not just getting the treats and the tea and the other things that are in those boxes, but actually having those vendor stories to kind of learn about, well, what exactly it is you're going to be eating or drinking.
Exactly. Yeah. So we're trying to create a whole kind of fun experience for people and get people thinking a little bit more about, you know, really appreciating the people in our own environment here in our own region who are doing really extraordinary things, and giving the small guys a chance to participate in the economy as well.
Absolutely. And typically when you think of getting gift boxes or gift bags or something like that, you often think about, you know, something you might pick up at a drugstore or somewhere, or something you might pick up online from Amazon or something like that, or another vendor. And typically you get nothing but national brands, like your Russell Stover chocolates, among other things. And, well, this is very different than that because, as you said, everything is 100% local made in those boxes.
Yes. And that's really what we're striving to do with this, is really help people connect directly with makers. And I think there's a hunger for that. We want to connect with one another. And this provides an opportunity for people. These are authentic. And like I say, they're real Minnesotans doing real cool things. And, you know, it's kind of like the reason we like to go to farmers markets often, and is that we like to be able to talk to the growers. We like to be able to meet the makers directly. And I think this helps those small people, because the small business people, because this can help to extend that for them and to get into homes and to help introduce them to the public. So it has a greater purpose besides just an awesome gift to give that you can be proud to give. It also is going to really help contribute to our economy and really help these small makers break into new sales channels and really become acquainted with new fans.
Of course, you guys have a wide variety of boxes that you're currently offering right now, and I'd like you to go through, let's pick one of your boxes that someone can choose right now and go through some of the products they'll find in there, and maybe tell us about some of the vendors.
Yes, absolutely. Well, there's so many to pick from, and honestly, they're equally popular. So I encourage people to look at our boxes on our website, and where we do ship anywhere in the country, included in the price. But the one that I think, one of the boxes I think is especially exciting and unique, is our Land of Lakes Tea Time box. Anybody you know who is a tea drinker would just absolutely love this box. It has two different tea offerings in there, as well as some treats that would go great with tea, and our fun little tea towel that we actually designed in-house and had printed at a St. Paul printer. It's printed on a flour sack towel that was made by the Berg Bag Company that's been operating in Minneapolis since the 1940s. So everything is totally local. I love the well-rooted tea is really special. She just, Rachel just founded this company around a year ago, and she actually uses herbs that have been grown from farms within 100 miles of the Twin Cities, from sustainable farms, and she also forages. 10% of the ingredients are from wild edibles from Minnesota forests. So you're getting a total Minnesota product. The tea is absolutely delicious, and we include a sampler set of all three of her teas so you can try them all. We also are featuring a new company, Ancient Indian Spices, and their chai mix, they do a variety of really amazing Indian spice blends right in-house. It's a St. Paul family with roots in India, and they really are on a mission to kind of teach Midwesterners about great Indian cuisine. Fabulous product, and so you can use that to make chai. We are including honey, of course, and our honey purveyor is Ames Farm Single Source Honey. They have a real claim to fame in that all of their honey is produced on their farm. And when you receive a bottle of their honey, you can tell the exact hive it came from because they print the hive number on the bottom of every bottle. And in fact, even the flower that the bee received the pollen from is on there as well. So it's super interesting.
That's unreal. You actually get that detailed of information. That is really cool.
It is very cool, and it's so unique. I mean, I've been geeking out on all the learning all this stuff because it's like, it's so amazing, and it's, you know, it's really cool what these people are doing, and they're all environmentally focused too, which I love. In fact, we've made a real effort at You Betcha Box to be as environmental as possible, and we have make sure that all of our packaging is recyclable or reusable. So even though we're shipping glass bottles across the country, you know, we use a corrugate wrap for that, so it looks decorative and attractive, but you can recycle everything in this. It's not there's no bubble wrap. The other products in that box I just want to mention are Isidore Nut Company, and Tasha makes an incredible organic mixed nut that is beautifully seasoned. We are including her Zesty Lemon Rosemary, which it just was nominated for a Good Food Award, so congratulations to her. And we are including these delicious raw coconut macaroons from Kuzala Macaroon, and in the cherry flavor, and they are just, I always say, an open bag is an empty bag. They're absolutely delicious. And some Annie's Caramels out of Matamidi, which are kind of a perennial favorite and pretty well known, actually. They're just yummy. And as I mentioned, this comes with our exclusive tea towel as well.
And the You Betcha Box really is perfect for just about any occasion as well, whether you're just giving it to maybe a relative, or I think this is also important to highlight, if you're a business who maybe is going to be trying to give something to your clients or to your employees, this is also a perfect option as well.
I think so. You know, we have some alternatives to some of the more generic national brands for, you know, and why not show your community spirit and your pride in where you're from by giving local and helping to support small businesses across the state. You know, I think that's really awesome because when we support each other, we can grow a stronger Minnesota. I have really tried to make that, how much good can we do with every box? That's part of our mission. So we are partnering now with a nonprofit in Eagan that serves disabled Minnesotans, provides trainings and employment for them. And they are packing every You Betcha box with care. And that's something that I feel great about. They're excited about our partnership, and they've been wonderful to work with.
All right, final question for you here, Katie. Where can people learn more information about ordering a You Betcha box and maybe choose one of the huge variety of boxes that you have available?
Well, we're so excited that we finally have our e-commerce going. So people can go right onto our website, which is youbetchabox.com. That's youbetchabox.com. And you can order there, and we include shipping in the price. If you want to, we're going to be taking orders through Thanksgiving that will hold until December because we know we're going to get a big push in December. And you can order there, and you can check at checkout. You could do hold till December if you want. And also, if you go on our website, you can look at the upcoming events section, and you see there where we are located, where you can come find us at various holiday boutiques and pop-ups around town. We are at Four Post at the Mall of America. We're excited to be there through the holiday season, as well as Potluck in Roseville, the new food hall.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, some options all over the metro area, and as you said, also online as well, which is a great option. Certainly beats going to Amazon or going to one of the national retailers. Definitely a good option to go for a You Betcha box for those gift-giving ideas coming up during this holiday season. All right, Katie, thanks so much for joining us again on the program.
You betcha.
Ah, gotta love you. Throwing that at the end there. All right, Katie, we'll talk to you later.
Thanks a lot. Take care.
And that's all the time we have on today's program. Coming up tomorrow, we're going to play back a Democracy Now! Forum they did on climate change that involved several of the Democratic candidates. It's actually a three-part forum, and we're going to play part one tomorrow, and then you'll be able to hear parts two and three during Thanksgiving week when Matt and I have some best of programming. So looking forward to that. And then coming up on Monday, Alan Miller will be filling in for me. Again, I'm back with a live show coming up next Tuesday. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It's Brett Johnson on the 4 o'clock show here on your Thursday afternoon. We're happy now to be speaking with Sam Berger. He is with the Center for American Progress. Sam Berger also worked at the Office of Management and Budget under the Obama administration, where he worked on a variety of legal and policy issues, including the government shutdown, the sequester, executive orders, presidential memoranda, and a whole lot more. And he can speak on a lot of issues that have been happening with impeachment, including a deposition that happened over the weekend with someone who actually served in the current Office of Management and Budget. So, Sam, thanks so much for joining us on the program today. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me on.
Absolutely. So let's start off with this first very basic question, because we'll get into that deposition. That let's provide some basic information, because even I don't necessarily know what this office does. What is the Office of Management and Budget, or OMB, and what does it do?
So the Office of Management and Budget is a part of the Executive Office of the President, and its role is sort of twofold. One is to put together the President's budget, and the second is to manage the way in which agencies spend the money that they get. And the reason for that is back in the old days, agencies would basically spend through the entirety of their funding, say, in 7 months and come back to the Congress. So the Navy would come back to Congress and say, hey, we have no money. Do you want us to, like, pull all the ships in and just stop, you know, stop operating for 5 months, or will you give us more? And of course, Congress had to give them more. And so they created an agency that could basically dole out funding at a regular interval such that agencies wouldn't spend too fast or too slow, and by the end of the year would have gotten all their money out.
So let's move on now to this deposition that happened over the weekend with Mark Sandy, who is the career employee of the Office of Management and Budget, and basically reported some unusual things that were happening. So, Sam, can you kind of summarize what he talked about over the weekend at this deposition and give us a little background about Sandy?
Mark Sandy is the career official at OMB who, under course of business, would sign off on things like funding hold through the apportionment process. Specifically for national security programs. And what happened in this case that was unusual is, first, he raised concerns about the legality of the action, and then ended up only signing a short-term hold. And subsequent to that, the White House cut him out of the process, violating longstanding OMB practice to have politicals continue this hold, which raises various very serious questions as to what exactly was going on and why what they were doing was something they didn't feel they could justify to career officials.
So is this also unusual as well to have someone who pretty much is a political appointee that we're going to be talking about basically come in and just stop aid funding to a foreign country, at least in your experience?
This on the whole is virtually unprecedented. First, it's incredibly unusual for the President of the United States to make a demand like that with respect to a particular aid program. And then obviously we've since discovered that it was part of a broader extortion scheme, which of course is perhaps the first time that this has ever happened to anyone's knowledge. But even then, it's highly unusual in these sorts of circumstances. So it is the case that aid can be withheld in a variety of circumstances because various benchmarks haven't been met or further conversation is necessary. But here, with respect to this Ukraine aid, every single agency involved had done all the proper steps. They had all coordinated, and all of them agreed that it was critical that this aid go out and go out quickly. Moreover, the aid itself, they made the White House aware that the holdup of this aid was actually illegal. And it was illegal because you have to spend the money that Congress gives you. But if you hold up funding for too long, the Department of Defense won't actually be able to spend it in time. And so they told OMB and the White House about this repeatedly. And in fact, the White House itself, OMB, acknowledged this fact in writing up its justifications. At first, when it was holding the aid, and remember, it was doing this on a regular basis, and so folks understand, this is done with a legal document signed by a specific person at a specific time that gives a specific reason why the money can't move. And so over time, they were doing this, you know, 2 weeks at a time or thereabouts. Suddenly, they start changing the justification. At first, they say, don't worry, this won't prevent this funding from basically going out on time. And as it goes on and on and on, and the Department of Defense says, we're not going to be able to get this out. What you're doing is illegal. They change that. They drop that sentence, tacitly acknowledging that they know what they're doing is illegal. So why is this so important? Well, the reason is the whole justification that they give is that Trump was very concerned about corruption. That's why he was holding up this money. But that doesn't make any sense. Why would you break the law because you were concerned about corruption in another country? It seems like what was really driving the case here was this extortion scheme. Moreover, this undermines this notion about why the money was released. Because there was a policy moment. There was an actual policy reason to release it weeks earlier, in August. And they blew through that deadline. No one seemed to even care. The agencies cared incredibly. The Ukrainians cared about that they weren't getting the funding, but the White House didn't care. Until they were alerted that there was a whistleblower complaint, and not just a whistleblower complaint, but that the House knew of it and was going to get their hands on it. So suddenly caught red-handed, they decide that that funding has to go out the door. Quick, get it out. We never held it up. We don't even know what you're talking about. And so as you understand the process that went into this, you realize honest career public servants cut out.
Yeah, absolutely.
The White House itself admitting that it was illegal, and then them only making the decision to release it after they got caught.
Yeah, and talking about Sandy, he even seemed pretty reluctant to even come through with this, being that he's, well, a career person who's worked there. He's not a political appointee. And even as we're talking here, Sam, someone who worked for OMB, if you had seen something like this happen when Obama was president, you certainly would have been alarmed and figured out that this is really unusual. And, well, we need to actually notify someone what's going on, because this is highly, highly, well, not good and very unusual.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's clear from the news reporting we've gotten regarding Mark Sandy's testimony that he was highly concerned. And he should be. This is a very unusual request. It was putting this funding at risk. It was creating all sorts of problems. And then after he starts asking questions, what do? They cut him out. And this isn't the first time we've seen this. Remember, the whole first week of testimony was about how honest people in the State Department were pushed aside, pulled away from their assignments, routed around. Why? Because they wouldn't be a part of the corruption. So the Trump administration needed to find people who would. We've already learned about that at the State Department, and what Mark Sandy can walk through is what exactly was happening along those same lines in the Office of Management Budget at the White House.
And we've seen this, as you were alluding to as well, with other officials who work in government, who are not political appointees, who have maybe raised some red flags or shown some concerns about what's been happening during the Trump administration, as you said, kind of just been shut out of the process, essentially, right?
Yes. I mean, this is what happens in a culture of corruption, right? The people that are honest get pushed aside. Why? Because they're causing problems. The people who are promoted, the people who get more authority, the people that are brought to the center, are those who are themselves corrupt or willing to look the other way. And what we've seen of these hearings is exactly that. Folks that have to stand up and say absurd things like, oh, I didn't realize that Burisma meant Biden, when everybody knows that that's what it meant. The president himself didn't even use Burisma. He said Biden. And so people going through these mental gymnastics to try and explain why they wouldn't acknowledge what was staring them in the face. They were part of an extortion campaign, and as much as they wanted it, in part to get Ukraine the aid that they thought that it needed, that's what they were doing. They were taking part in the president's extortion campaign. For what purpose? To attempt to undermine the upcoming elections,
and
to damage his political opponents.
Yeah, absolutely. And what we've often been hearing from the Republican side when it comes to the impeachment hearings is that, oh, well, these are people who have political bias or they have motive to lie. And as we're kind of talking about here, these are career employees who are really not very high profile. And to me, it would seem like they would have no reason to lie simply because, well, lying under oath gets you in a lot of trouble. And it would probably hurt their career as well if they were to go in front of Congress, or in the case of Sandy, before a deposition and straight up lie, right?
Right. These are the folks that have literally no reason to lie. the people that have a reason to lie are those that were directly involved, those who were part of the extortion plot. And in fact, what we've seen with Ambassador Sondland's testimony is that reaches to the highest levels of government, that Pompeo knew, Mulvaney knew, Pence knew, and they all helped carry it out. And those are the folks, the exact same folks, who refused to testify, who refused to provide documents, who refused to say anything under oath. Why? Because they know what they did was wrong, because they don't want to be caught. That's why you cover up, because you know what you did was wrong. And what we're seeing is a cover-up from the White House, not a particularly effective one, but at its highest reaches, when you're talking about Pompeo, when you're talking about Mulvaney, when you're talking about Pence, when you're talking about Trump himself, there it has been effective. But it's been the career officials, the people who see their oath as one to the Constitution and not to Trump, who have come forward and pointed out this wrongdoing.
We've been speaking with Sam Berger. He used to work for the Obama administration at the Office of Management and Budget. Hey, Sam, thanks so much for joining us on the program today. Appreciate it.
No problem. My pleasure. Thanks so much for having me on.
And coming up next, we're going to have an interview about a great new gift idea as we approach the holiday season. It's called the You Betcha Box, and we're going to learn more about that up next.